Hello, everyone. I'm Jonathan Bechtel, the COO and the General Counsel of the Foundation for Government Accountability, and I want to welcome all of you to today's call. The FGA builds paths to better lives by equipping leaders with proven strategies to reform health and welfare programs in states all across America. Many of you are our partners in this, and we certainly look forward to working with you, continue to work with you to develop, promote, and implement solutions to these tough problems in your states. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to join us today. We have people from 20 different states, so all across the country, and especially want to thank our co-sponsors of this call at the Galen Institute, the Institute for Policy Innovation, the Mercatus Center, and the State Policy Network. We appreciate very much their helping us spread the word about this important topic and the call today. Now, we're privileged to be joined as well by two distinguished guests that we're going to hear from and that you'll get a chance to ask questions of. First of all, we're going to start with the FGA Director of Research, Jonathan Ingram, who's going to spend a little bit of time discussing his new report called The Exaggerated Epidemic. This report we sent out this morning in our last reminder email, and we'll send it out as well again after the call. Secondly, we're going to hear from Dr. Robert Grabois, who is the Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at the George Mason University. Dr. Grabois also served as the Senior Healthcare Advisor for the National Federation of Independent Businesses during the passage of the Affordable Care Act and throughout the legal challenge by NFIB, so certainly close to many of these issues. Dr. Grabois is going to be discussing some of the broader impacts of Medicaid expansion on businesses, particularly the small businesses that are really the lifeblood of our economy. After both of our guests have presented, we will make sure that there's plenty of time for you to ask questions. And at that time, we'll tell you kind of how to do that. It's a pretty simple process. Before we do that, though, we're going to dive into our topic and give our guests an opportunity to present for a few minutes. Now, I'm sure that most of you are probably very familiar with the Affordable Care Act's employer mandate, which requires that all employers with at least 50 full-time equivalent employees must offer affordable health insurance to any employee who works at least 30 hours per week. Now, any such employers who fail to offer affordable insurance could be subject to substantial tax penalties. Some folks have suggested that Medicaid expansion is a way to shield businesses from these tax penalties. They argue that if a state does not expand Medicaid, many businesses will then be on the hook for up to $3,000 for each worker who has not been given affordable health insurance. This theory is supported by a widely cited report from Jackson Hewitt, the nation's second largest tax preparation company. So one of the questions, probably the big question we're going to talk about today is whether that's true, first of all, and then secondly, whether states should expand Medicaid just to save businesses from the employer mandate, whether that's a good strategy. So we're going to start off, as I mentioned, with Jonathan Ingram and ask him to explain first a little bit more about the Obamacare penalties and how the employer mandate works. And then the theory put forward by Jackson Hewitt that says that Medicaid expansion could help prevent these penalties from being put in place. So, Jonathan, why don't you talk to us about those two things for a little bit?
Right. Well, I think it's really important to understand sort of what Jackson Hewitt was trying to analyze to really understand why they got it so horribly wrong. As you mentioned, Obamacare sort of has these two types of penalties for large employers. Both penalties are really triggered when an employee gets an Obamacare subsidy on the exchange. One type of penalty is offered if they don't provide any health insurance to their full-time workers. In that case, they pay $2,000 per full-time employee, not just on those getting the subsidies, but on their entire workforce, their entire full-time employees. That includes people who are on Medicaid, people who are receiving health insurance somewhere else, like through their spouse's employer or something like that. And the second kind of penalty is that if the coverage that the employer offers is really unaffordable, then they would pay $3,000 per employee who actually receives the Obamacare subsidy. Because the way that Obamacare was written, people between 100 and 138% of the federal poverty level actually qualify for subsidies if states don't expand Medicaid, but they lose those subsidies if states do expand Medicaid. So it's really this second type of penalty for offering quote-unquote unaffordable coverage that could be even affected by the Medicaid expansion. So Jackson Hewitt hired a couple of people that used to work for Tennessee's Obamacare Exchange to try to find out what kind of penalties would be paid for this really narrow sliver of people, you know, these full-time workers who only earn between 100 and 138% of the federal poverty level. And, of course, they said there would be this huge doomsday scenario, several billions of dollars per year, and Obamacare penalties should states say no. But their analysis is really based on several unsupported assumptions about how low-income people are distributed across the states, about who can really even trigger the penalties, and really the behavior of what large employers will ultimately do. Their conclusions also clearly and flatly contradict estimates put out by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. So it's pretty clear that lawmakers shouldn't really rely on these couple of flawed-filled reports when making their Medicaid expansion decisions. Ultimately, one of the earliest flaws that I noted was that they were using some really strange assumptions. Instead of actually using the data that they say that they're citing, which is the census, to find out how many people fall into this narrow sliver of population, they actually decided to just make an unjustified assumption about how states' populations were distributed. That has major impacts. In Utah, for example, they actually assume that about twice as many people fall into this income group than the census say actually belongs there. In Missouri, they overestimate it by about 65%, which amounts to about 15,000 people. And they don't really come up with a good explanation for why they use this assumption, especially when the data is freely available from the very sources they're citing. The second major flaw that I saw was that they included a lot of employees who, by law, can't even trigger the employer penalties. This includes people who are already eligible for Medicaid. So you have some older children, some young adults, some low-income parents who are eligible for Medicaid before the Obamacare expansion. And we know that people who are already eligible for Medicaid can't trigger the penalties under Obamacare because they can't receive Obamacare subsidies. And so they also include, strangely, seasonal and part-year workers who also don't trigger penalties. You know, nationally, about a third of the people that Jackson Hewitt includes are these seasonal workers. In some states, that actually bumps up to about three-quarters of the people that they think could trigger these penalties are actually seasonal workers who can't. And it's really unclear why they do this, and the law is pretty clear on that point. And then the last major assumption that they made is perhaps the strangest. You know, they assume that about 93% of these workers aren't offered affordable coverage. But they base that on a really, really gross misreading of a report by the Urban Institute. And when you actually read that report, you find out that the 93% figure actually includes people who couldn't trigger the penalty at all because either they work at small businesses who weren't subject to the mandate or because they don't work at all. And so what the study actually found was that as few as 1% of these uninsured full-time employees are offered what's considered under Obamacare unaffordable coverage. And that's really the group we're talking about here. So it's kind of interesting that Jackson Hewitt's put out these sort of these annual reports now 2 years in a row, claiming these doomsday scenarios if states don't expand Medicaid, when the very data that they're saying they're using to reach those conclusions paints a very, very different picture. And of course, that doesn't even get into the fact that, you know, for 2 years in a row, the employer mandate has been completely or partially delayed, and employers are going to do whatever they can to limit their exposure to Obamacare penalties, regardless of what a state decides to do on Medicaid.
Thanks, Jonathan, very much for that overview and for the research on that. That's very enlightening. That's kind of open up a little bit there of the facts behind the facts, if you will, of what has been portrayed as doomsday, but maybe isn't quite so much as of a doomsday as it might look. Let's change gears now and talk to or hear from Dr. Grabois, who has been researching the impacts of Obamacare on employers for a long time. Dr. Grabois, would you add your comments to Jonathan and talk about whether you think small businesses would be smart to push for Medicaid expansion or if that's actually more harmful to them in these states?
Sure, absolutely, and thanks so much for having me. First of all, businesses ought to think long and hard about buying into the Medicaid expansion. That's It's whether they're small, whether they're large, medium-sized, it doesn't matter. And furthermore, what I'm going to talk about, that what I just said holds true if Jonathan Ingram's analysis is correct. It's also true if Jackson Hewitt's analysis is correct. Again, they need to think long and hard about this, and you can read between the lines and say, no, I don't think they ought to be advocating it. Back in 2009, Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat of Oregon, said, before the whole law passed, Medicaid is a caste system. It is unfair to poor people, and it is unfair to taxpayers. His words are truer than ever. Now, the businesses we're talking about are, in fact, taxpayers, and when the financial ramifications of this expansion take hold, businesses are going to be especially hard hit. I'm going to also add and expand upon business owners who believe in private markets and think private markets are desirable in healthcare and in other fields. They ought to think twice about it for that reason as well, and also business owners who do care about the health of their employees and their neighbors and their families. Once again, there's another good reason not to be enthusiastic about this expansion. So let me get into explaining why I say these things. So first of all, the expansion is not good for business. The Jackson Hewitt is a very partial analysis, as are most of the analyses floating around. To buy the expansion argument that's made in this and other studies, you have to buy the following sequence. Take a whole bunch of your employees, shove them on over into Medicaid, get the employees off of your plan, lose the employer mandate obligations, and you're off scot-free. You saved that $3,000 or two, whatever. Now, to believe this, you have to believe that the federal government gets its money from a gigantic, magical ATM up in the sky. In truth, if we expand Medicaid in this way, the money's going to come from one of three places. Either there are going to be higher federal and state taxes, in which case businesses are going to be paying those, or we're going to borrow more money from overseas, pile up additional debt, and the businesses are going to pay there, or we're going to have to cut other federal programs, thereby ramping down some of the routes where businesses find income elsewhere. In any of these scenarios, the businesses are going to pay. They're going to be paying the burden. The burden will be harder to see, but it's still going to be there. And I would contend that because of Medicaid's inefficiencies, and it is a horrifically inefficient program, the burden may well end up larger than just that $3,000 penalty or the cost of insurance, whatever. Businesses may sense some transitory savings as this happens, but the unintended consequences, the indirect consequences, will wipe out any transitory savings, I think, fairly quickly. So, in sum, it's not a great thing for the business, the bottom line. Secondly, it's terribly unfair to employees. Now, the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, already has given businesses enormous incentives to cut the number of employees, to get them below that 50 number of full-timers and full-time equivalents. It has already given businesses incentives to cut employees' hours. Again, if you can get them down below the 30 hours a week to 29, you, again, lose that obligation. Now, with this expansion, we are adding to some incentives, actually, that are already in it, but now we're augmenting the incentives to cut employees' wages, because an employer is going to have to look there, and if they their employee is somewhere just north of that Medicaid line, they know all I have to do is keep cut this guy's wages or keep him below the line, and I will not have that obligation. In this sense, it gives employers all sorts of incentives to treat similar employees in very different fashion. Now, another aspect that's unfair to the employees is, Medicaid is a hugely expensive program, and it provides really rotten quality, coverage, care, and outcomes. Again, harking back to what the senator said 5 years back. First of all, Medicaid has never been particularly good at enrolling people. It's interesting, about 16% of the people who are eligible for Medicaid historically have not managed to get enrolled because of the inefficiencies of the program. You know, coincidentally, that's just about identical to the 16% of the Americans who don't have any insurance. So Medicaid's no better at enrolling people than others. Once they do get enrolled, they find it difficult to get care. Many, many, many doctors, and especially the better doctors and better hospitals, better institutions, refuse to take Medicaid. And so these people go off to the emergency room. Very expensive care. It grossly underpays the doctors, so they have no motive to accept Medicaid patients. Now, beyond that, once people get their care through Medicaid, once they're in the system, they've gotten care, their health improves relatively little over actually being uninsured. Now, I'm not going to say some people make the argument that go from uninsured to Medicaid and your health gets worse. I'm not going to state that. It's not true overall. There is some benefit to having a Medicaid card in your wallet. However, it's not a great benefit. And secondly, there are areas of medical care where, in fact, Medicaid recipients don't seem to fare as well health-wise as the uninsured. Now, we can quibble over how powerful the data are, but there are an awful lot of academic studies that come out with that bottom line. Now, there's another big one, and this is a philosophical one. If you want all of us to be rolled into a single-payer system, which plenty of people who supported the law would really love, well, this is a great start. So we're going to take those people from 100% to 138% of the federal poverty level, move them on out of private insurance, and move them on over into Medicaid. Let me put that in dollar terms. For a family of four, that's roughly $24,000 to $32,000 annual income. So you move them out of private into Medicaid. First of all, there's a fairness issue there. Those tens of millions of people in that category, they have access to private coverage that works, private insurance with real networks of doctors and such. And in order to expand Medicaid, you are required to snatch their coverage away, coverage they're happy with, and move them on into something they are most certainly not going to be happy with. Now, let me look a little bit at the logic here. The argument here is, well, you know, if we take those 100 to 138s and move them on to Medicaid, you lose your obligation. It's great for your bottom line. Well, if that's true, you can look at the businesses and quite similarly say, hey, why don't we move the 138s to 200 or the 200 to 400? Why don't we just move everyone into Medicaid and then your bottom line will be great? Well, again, we all know that the tax burden that would accrue as a result of that would be horrendous, and the health effects on the employees would be terrible. Again, to repeat, it's a hugely expensive program. And businesses that would support into this expansion or expansions beyond, and I guarantee you if this expansion goes through, there will be calls to expand further, the businesses are going to be paying huge taxes to support it. So kind of summing it up, it's bad for business, it's bad for employees, it's bad for health, it's bad for markets, it's bad for the economy, and we need to explore alternatives. It's not a choice of this expansion or do nothing and walk away. There are alternatives out there, and we need to look deeper at them. Some of them probably provide better care at lower cost. We need especially to look at some of those. And if you don't mind my putting in a slight plug, a lot of these issues are covered in a book that the Mercatus Center is going to be issuing in April, The Economics of Medicaid, Costs and Consequences, and maybe we can discuss it further in Q&A, but I'll leave it at that. So thanks much. I'm about done.
Okay. Thanks so much for that covering that all those different topics. That's very, very helpful. Sure. I'm sure that some of our folks have questions, and we want to allow them plenty of time to ask questions. So in just a moment, we'll open it up for Q&A, so get those questions ready.
Before we do that, though, I wanted to ask Jonathan Ingram to update us on something that many have seen as one of those alternatives to Medicaid expansion, but is another one that isn't quite what it seems. That's the private option that has been tried in the state of Arkansas and has been looked at by some other states. We did a call on this a few weeks ago and talked about the ins and outs of it, and there have been a couple of really important key developments in Arkansas since that time. So while people are thinking of their questions for our guests, Jonathan, would you just give us a short update on what has changed and what we've seen happen in Arkansas in the past couple of weeks?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, a few weeks ago, we really discussed a lot of the empty promises that some of the lawmakers were making in Arkansas for their Medicaid expansion plan, which they call the private option. For those who don't really know, Arkansas received a waiver from the federal government so that they could deliver basically regular Medicaid benefits, but deliver them through an Obamacare exchange plan. But as with all waivers, they had to prove that it was budget neutral. They had a lot of little crafty things built into that to try to up the costs of the budget neutrality agreement so that it looked like it was more it was less expensive than it really is. But ultimately, they did have to agree to a cap with the federal government for how much the feds will reimburse the state for Medicaid expansion. And it turns out that, after just 2 months, the per-person costs, which are what the cap applies to, are about 10% higher than their consultants originally estimated. So they're already above the federal cap, which means that, if this trend continues, and there's several reasons to believe it will, given the basic design of the program, which we talked about a few weeks ago, the state's going to be on the hook for millions of dollars for a program that was promised to be, 100% federally funded because it's a Medicaid expansion. And so taxpayers in Arkansas are really already starting to see that they're going to be on the hook for these costs, far earlier than they expected. Not going to be that 3 years of free money. It turns out that they're actually going to be on the hook for substantial amounts even in the first couple of years. And so this really should serve as an example to leaders in other states who are really trying to think about this kind of expansion plan and decide whether it's best for their state. Not only is it bad policy for the many reasons that we've outlined in the past, but it really places your state at even more of a financial risk than a regular Medicaid expansion would.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. And so for anyone in a state that is looking at Arkansas's example or talking to folks about that, certainly would encourage you to take a look at Jonathan's analysis of this cost overrun that's already occurred. You can find it. We sent it out in the email this morning, a link to it, but you can also find it on our website at uncoverobamacare.com. All right, well, let's move to a question and answer session here. And the way this works is that you can press *6 to ask a question, and then we'll just kind of go through the questions that are there and let you know when it's your turn to ask. Certainly, I know some of our co-sponsors are on the call as well, and if they have any updates they'd like to give, certainly press *6 as well, and we'll make sure we get to you. Let's start with a question that was submitted in advance. Dr. Graybois, this is for you. You mentioned that Medicaid expansion is something that all businesses, large or small or medium, should think very, very carefully about before they support. And yet we've seen in some of the states a real split in support from the business community for expansion. So, for instance, in many states, groups like NFIB were against it for many of the reasons you suggested, but then we saw state chambers and similar groups that were in favor. Can you talk about why do we see that split and how should people respond to a difference there even in the business community over this issue?
Sure. Part of it, I have no doubt, is simply the political differences in the states. Some states are more supportive of the law in its entirety. So you have a lot of philosophical differences from one state to another. But I think a lot of it comes down to what I noted, that a lot of people have looked at it on a very partial basis. I will lose any obligation to buy insurance, and I will lose that $3,000 penalty, and that's the end of the story. And I would say in some places an inadequate job has been done of, let's say, informing the businesses that you are going to be paying that. You may not be writing the $3,000 check in exactly that fashion, but it will come back to bite you through some indirect path. You're not going to save money by doing this. So I think there is a lack of understanding of that complete process. And there's kind of a tendency to think of, you know, federal money just kind of comes magically into the states and it doesn't come from anywhere. So I guess that's the two things, politics and incomplete analysis.
Jonathan, would you add anything?
Well, I think that there's also just a difference in sort of the makeup of sort of the state chambers and NFIB members generally. A lot of the state chambers have been, you know, actively pursuing some of the special interest groups that are really pushing Medicaid expansion. So in a lot of states, you'll see that hospital executives are on the boards for state chambers of commerce. So you get a lot of the hospital groups, a lot of the insurance companies, some of the people who are really pushing for Medicaid expansion being on the boards of the chambers, and that might play a role in it too.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that.
Excellent. Thank you both for answering that. We have a question that's come in, so go ahead with your question. Yes, ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Craig DeFessa with Middle Resolution in Virginia, and I recently read in Arkansas that they've just passed, after several attempts, to start funding the Arkansas plan again. And that one of the representatives there, maybe Jonathan, you can provide some more clarification on this, switched his vote. And the reason why is because if they didn't pass this funding, that a lot of people would be thrown off of Medicaid because initially they were placed on Medicaid because of the plan. And my point here is to legislators is that, you know, one of the arguments they use to say if the federal government doesn't keep up their commitment, then, well, we'll just disenroll all these people. But my argument is it's politically impossible to do, and I think Arkansas demonstrates that. Jonathan, could you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is one of the major arguments for the last person who ended up flipping his vote. As you mentioned, the vote had failed four times just a few weeks earlier, and they'd voted every single day, and it kept failing, kept failing, kept failing. And eventually one person in the Senate actually flipped their vote because they were getting due to horse trading, they were getting a different deal out of it. And then in the House, one person flipped their vote saying, well, you know, obviously we've now put 100,000 people on the Medicaid program, even if they've only been there 2 months, you know, it's impossible for us to take those people off now. And so this idea that, you know, 3 years down the road, you're suddenly going to throw those people off of Medicaid is really suspect, not only just for legal reasons of whether you could do it or not, but just for political reasons of, you know, what's the political reality of throwing hundreds of thousands of people off of Medicaid, even if they are able-bodied childless adults.
Yeah. Jonathan, if you don't mind, I'll chime in on that one as well.
Please do.
Yeah, this has been an interesting part of the argument. If you don't expand, you're going to throw all of these people out in the cold. But again, the way Congress designed the expansion was specifically in order to add all those people up to 100% of the poverty level, you are going to have to throw that 100 to 138 bunch out of private insurance. I don't know. They're sort of holding their coverage hostage to the other group. The question to me is not, you know, should you throw these people out in the cold? Rather, it is, why did Congress construct it in this way that forces states to throw them in the cold if they don't want to expand all the way up to 138. I don't know what the motives were. I don't know whether it was bad drafting or whether it was sort of a cynical ploy to essentially coerce the states into doing this. It certainly gave a powerful political motive, but my answer in that is go back to Congress and say, you know, you can fix this. You can allow the expansion up to 100 without bothering those people who are above 100. Ask your congressman why they don't do that.
Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you for the good question. If anyone else has questions, again, you can press star 6 to get into the question queue. And let me, Jonathan, ask you a follow-up question that was sent to us. This is essentially kind of a recap of your conversation about the Jackson Hewitt study, but could you just talk again for a moment about you're saying that businesses are very likely to be on the hook for a whole lot less than Jackson Hewitt study implies. Is that right, that there will be many less businesses that are potentially going to be in trouble with that than they're saying?
Yeah, well, and you really need to consider the very, very narrow sliver of people we're talking about here. So, you know, full-time employers must have at least 50 full-time equivalents. To be subject to the mandate, they have to have more than 30 actual full-time employees, not just equivalents. And they actually have to either not offer health insurance to full-time workers, or the coverage has to be unaffordable, which means that it costs more than 9.5% of their household income. And to trigger the penalties, at least one of their full-time workers has to get the Obamacare subsidy, which means that they have to be between that 100 to 138% of the federal poverty level. Although if the individuals above 138% of the federal poverty level go and get an Obamacare subsidy, the employer is still subject to the mandate for that. But the Medicaid expansion really only affects that small group between 100 and 138. And those would be the only workers who would, quote-unquote, be saved under a Medicaid expansion for that employer. But even then, Medicaid workers count in determining whether you're actually subject to the mandate. They count in the penalty for not offering insurance whatsoever. So the only time that it really affects the business is if it's offering what the government determines is unaffordable insurance to people who are at 100% of the federal poverty level that is considered affordable for people who are at 138%. And so when you look at it, employers would actually have to actively decide to pay the penalty rather than either restructure their compensation or restructure the workforce. You know, the wisest action, which, you know, most employers are looking at right now, a lot of them are already taking it, is to simply restructure the workforce so that the people who Obamacare classifies as full-time workers who wouldn't otherwise qualify for full-time benefits under business's usual model operating policies, reduce their hours so that they no longer qualify under Obamacare. And so what you're seeing is a lot of people who were working 30 to 35 hours per week maybe, having their hours reduced to probably 25 to 29 hours per week. And that's really the best move that employers have to make sure that they're not subject to the mandate. They could also do a few other things if Obamacare calls their current insurance, quote-unquote, unaffordable, which in many cases is still cheaper than paying the penalty. You know, employers are smart. They're going to find the best way to keep their payroll costs down, and they're going to do that. And the Medicaid expansion isn't some kind of, you know, really silver bullet to save employers.
Thank you for that clarification, Jonathan. Some of this is hard to keep your hands wrapped around, though, because it seems like the landscape is changing so often. Dr. Graybois, maybe you could talk for a moment about just we've seen a couple now of delays of the employer mandate by the Obama administration. Could you just quickly walk us through what delays have we seen, where are we at right now, and how does that impact this whole issue of Medicaid expansion for employers?
Right. That's a great question, and I think it has an enormous impact on how businesses are thinking about this and probably ought to be thinking about it. So first of all, sort of arbitrarily shoved the whole thing off for a year. And then there was a second one so that businesses between 50 and 100 would be pushed an additional year. And let's see, we've been on the phone for about a half an hour. For all I know, something else has changed since we've been on the phone. But if I were a business, I would really be asking the question, are they ever going to activate, implement the employer mandate? And personally, I'm kind of doubting that they ever will. It's not being pushed off for economic or operation reasons. I mean, I think it's an enormous burden, and it's an awareness that businesses are going to react in highly unpredictable ways if it ever is imposed. And I just have a big question mark as to whether they are ever actually going to say, okay, it's actually going into effect. So if I were a business, that would be part of my calculation.
That's a really great point. And, I mean, I think it's also interesting to know that one of the other delays that they made with this is even the employers with over 100 workers are subject to a much smaller mandate than what the law originally required. Now they only have to offer coverage to, I think it's 70% of their full-time employees. And so, you know, beyond all the problems with sort of the Jackson-Hewitt analysis of Medicaid expansion in general, you know, it's really unclear why states should buy this argument that they should dump, you know, nearly $1 trillion into Obamacare's Medicaid expansion over the next decade just to save employers, you know, a few billion that may never actually even be fully implemented.
Yep.
It's a great point. As I mentioned before, if anyone has any additional questions they'd like to ask, certainly press *6. But let me throw out another one that was sent in ahead of the call. There are, kind of speaking of things that may change the landscape, there are several lawsuits that are underway that are also attempting to block portions of the employer mandates. Dr. Grabois, is there anything that we should be watching with those lawsuits that could change the landscape here for businesses and the mandate?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's probably the most interesting, I'd say certainly the most interesting judicial issue out there. Of course, the Supreme Court upheld the individual mandate, so to speak, by redefining it from a penalty to a tax. But there is there is another suit or set of suits that really came out of Michael Cannon over at Cato and Jonathan Adler, a law professor who was working with him. And they are arguing, and I think they have some pretty solid arguments. I'm not an attorney, so I have no idea how the courts will rule on it, but their argument was that the language of the law makes very clear that these subsidies are only available in exchanges that are set up by the states, not those large number that have been set up by the federal government, all the healthcare.gov states. And I'm not a lawyer, but I have read those parts, and indeed it certainly looks as if the subsidies were only to be given in those state exchanges. Well, they've interpreted it to say, no, well, we're going to extend it farther. And I've read the arguments that suggest that it's a weak legal argument. And again, I'll defer to the attorneys and I'll defer to the courts on that one. But if the courts were to buy the Cannon and Adler logic, you would have a huge part of the United States where people could not get subsidies through the exchanges, and I think the law would be thrown into utter pandemonium. So all of the discussions we're having here would be trivialities next to what ensued. Again, it'll be very interesting to see how the courts view it.
Right. And
yes,
if the court
definitely
actually accepts that argument, you know, I think the plaintiffs have a very good case in that the employer mandate doesn't apply in states that don't set up their own exchange, because the employer mandate's only triggered if an employee actually receives an Obamacare subsidy. And so it's interesting to see sort of the broad array of challenges that this kind of thing is getting. You know, the Attorney General of Oklahoma filed a lawsuit. Several employers in multiple states have filed lawsuits. The state of Indiana filed its own. A bunch of local school districts filed lawsuits. And so, you know, a lot of people are challenging this, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, just thanks for reminding me. I had meant to say that point, too. The only way that the employer mandate is triggered is if at least one of your employees gets a subsidy. And so if the court says no, none of your employees are entitled to subsidies, you know, from this non-lawyer's opinion, there would be no employer mandate applicable in that state, and that's kind of the heart of the argument.
Yeah, clearly it would make a pretty huge difference, so certainly something to keep a close eye on. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, press star 6, and we will go to our next question. Please go ahead with your question.
Hello, this is Grace Marie Turner of the Galen Institute. Thank you so much for allowing us to co-sponsor this call with you. I think you're very close to the concerns that states have, and I think this issue about whether or not states will be harmed if a state does not expand Medicaid is really important to answer, and I think you've done a terrific job in with your paper in particular in answering that very flawed Jackson Hewitt study. So thank you very much for that. But to this issue about the employer mandate, just so you know, there are actually will be oral arguments this a week from Tuesday in the D.C. Circuit Court in a major case involving the challenge to whether or not federal subsidies can flow through the federal exchange to people in complete contradiction of the wording of the statute. The Galen Institute filed an amicus brief in this in which we made a very strong argument. Our whole amicus was organized around states' rights and that this is yet another of the same kind of directive from the federal government that we saw with the Medicaid expansion, which the Supreme Court said was optional for the state. So I would be happy to send you the link to our amicus so that you can circulate that to the group as well. I think there's some really important states' rights arguments that we need to be including in our work. And just to clarify, the employer mandate is in effect whether or not a state would expand Medicaid. It's the penalties that could not be applied. There are a lot of other things to the employer mandate, including a whole battery of reporting requirements, et cetera, that employers have to comply with. But the penalty in particular could be stopped if a state, if these lawsuits are successful and it's not possible for federal subsidies to flow through the 35 states that have opted for a federal exchange and not set up state exchanges.
Thank you so much for clarifying that, and absolutely, please do send us the amicus brief and we'll make sure that it gets around to everyone on the call. And just thank you so much for everything that you do and for co-sponsoring the call. We're so glad to have you as an ally in these conversations. We have another question, so we will go ahead with that. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Mike Thompson with the Thomas Jefferson Institute. We are told here in our budget battle over Medicaid that 400,000 people are not covered. The question I have is those 400,000 that are not covered by Medicaid, a whole lot of them could very likely be covered with health insurance, which is an issue which has not been discussed of whether those 400,000 are truly sitting out there with no insurance. But the way they word it, they're not covered by Medicaid. They may very well be covered otherwise. And I'm just wondering where we might be able to find that out. We did a survey last summer that showed that 59% of those who are on Medicaid today had insurance before they went on Medicaid, which is why this whole issue of the 400,000 I'm asking.
This is Bob. I would just say either intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know that the data exists to actually answer that. Obviously, we're not getting very good information on how many people have actually enrolled, as we now hurdle toward the end of March, or how many of the people who have enrolled actually already had insurance, or how many people who had insurance are no longer enrolled. We're certainly not getting flows of data enough to really understand what's going on, and the question you just named is one that has been a big question mark for a long time. I don't know that anyone could answer it.
And I'll just follow up on that a little bit. And, you know, we see this in a lot of states. The interesting thing is the pro-expansion people consistently use data that includes people who are currently eligible for Medicaid, you know, pre-Obamacare, and Virginia does this as well, about 17%, 18% of the people that they say are, you know, eligible under the expansion are actually already eligible for Medicaid, and they just haven't signed up yet. About 17% of that 400,000 figure. And then they also include people who, as, you know, Bob has pointed out before, are currently eligible for subsidies, but those subsidies go away if the state expands Medicaid. So all in all, it ends up being about 40% of the uninsured adults who are, you know, under this 138% FPL level, who either currently are eligible for private insurance through the exchanges or are already eligible for Medicaid and wouldn't even be affected by the expansion at all. But I think it's really important to keep in mind, you know, who this population is to begin with. You know, these are able-bodied adults. Most of them have no dependent children, so it's a group of people that have never qualified for other types of welfare. You know, they can't qualify for cash assistance. They don't qualify for long-term food stamps. So they've never really been considered part of the, you know, the core social safety net. And this idea that, you know, suddenly we should create a new entitlement for these able-bodied adults with no disabilities keeping them from working is a little strange.
You know, one of the ironies of this whole thing is that if you go back to March 2010, before the whole law passed, there were probably somewhere between 10 and 12 million people eligible for Medicaid who were not signed up and were in a circumstance where if they became ill, you could retroactively sign up. If they had decided in March 2010, instead of passing this act, why don't we just send a bunch of people out with clipboards and sign up the people who are already eligible? It would have done far more to expand insurance coverage in America than anything possible when this bill washes out. But, of course, that's not what was done.
Great point and great question. Thanks for asking that. We've got time for a couple more questions. So, again, you can press star six if you want to jump into the conversation. We will go now to a question from South Dakota. Please go ahead with your question.
Yes. Please don't ignore South Dakota. You know, we have Tom Daschle still active in pushing Obamacare. And what South Dakota has done, this is a question for your sponsor from the Galen Institute. We have a very different kind of an exchange. It's not a state exchange, they say, and they say it's not a federal exchange. We're the only one that has one that's like a federal partnership, but not really. So I'm wondering, how does our kind of exchange fit in with either the federal, where you can have the subsidies, or the state, where you cannot have the subsidies, when we're at a quasi-partnership?
That's a really great question. And so the interesting thing is that these partnerships, which are starting to pop up in a couple different states, aren't actually defined in the law. And so you have to look in sort of the regulations of where they came up with this idea of a partnership. And ultimately what it means is that these are federal exchanges, not state exchanges. They're set up under the section of Obamacare that creates federal exchanges. And so in those states with the, you know, quasi-partnership exchanges, if these lawsuits pan out, those employers in those states would still be free from the penalties of the employer mandate.
Dr. Grayboys, did you have anything to add on that?
Nope. That was a great answer.
All right. Thanks, gentlemen. Again, we've got time probably for one more question. So feel free to hit star six to jump in the queue. I do have another follow-up question, maybe a final one, for Dr. Grayboys. Could you talk just a little bit about, now that we've seen a few months of the expansions being in place, we have a little bit of history to look to as to how those are going.
Could you talk for a moment, and certainly Jonathan Ingram, you can jump on this as well, about what we're seeing so far, and then maybe also tell us just a little bit more about your book that's coming out and how people can get a hold of that when it's published.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the fact is, as I said a minute ago, we really don't have a very clear picture. It's a very smoky lens that we're looking through. And again, I don't know whether it's because data are being withheld or because, if you look at the disaster with the website, you know, perhaps the data simply not attainable. I think the best guess is that we're either going to see when March has finished passing, and if we ever see the data, the number of people in America who were covered will have either conceivably dropped slightly. More likely, it will have increased slightly, not a great deal, maybe by a couple of million. Given that coverage was the major stated objective of this, it will not have done a very good job of that. And we will have, assuming that a couple of million extra people are added, we will have done that at an enormous cost and complete disruption of the healthcare system. I know people personally who are tearing their hair out trying to find out whether they're covered. They've found that their network has shrunk, that they can't go to their specialist that they've been going to. It is an enormous turmoil in individual human lives. So, again, I suspect we will end up with a slight expansion in coverage and a worsening in the coverage that people actually have. Now, the second point, the book that we've got out is called The Economics of Medicaid, Assessing the Costs and Consequences. It'll be available through Mercatus, I think, sometime in early to mid-April. And it's going to, it's a nice book. It'll cover the structure of Medicaid, what drives the cost of it, the federal side and the state side of the budget equations, Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. We'll have a physician's perspective on it, how some potentials on how to reform it, hard truth on trying to achieve sustainable reform. And then the last chapter I had the pleasure of writing was called Medicaid and Health, when I actually looked at does this program actually make people healthier? And as I said, the answer is maybe it makes them a little healthier, but certainly not nearly as healthy as real health insurance, real programs do. So I think it's going to be great when it's written by 9 or 10 of the most outstanding names here in D.C. and elsewhere. And you can get it through Mercatus.org. Just, you know, keep your eyes out. You're welcome to email me if you want to find out. But otherwise, it'll certainly be on the Mercatus site sometime in probably about a month or a little less.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate the effort that you put into that and sort of look forward to that. I want to go ahead and wrap up and honor folks' time. So maybe we can have just a little bit of closing comments and your kind of the parting thoughts, if you will, from our guests. Jonathan, let me start with you. Would you give us kind of your closing thoughts on this issue and where people can go and address this in their own states?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, lawmakers in several states are really taking the right approach and trying to fully understand this Obamacare Medicaid expansion before really diving, you know, headfirst into it. I think that's why a lot of states have really opted out of the Medicaid expansion, because once they fully understood the true facts surrounding it, they realize it's not as good as advertised. And so, you know, the flawed assumptions and the inconsistent data and all the other miscalculations made by sort of this Jackson-Hewitt study urging states to expand Medicaid, I think that really sets Jackson-Hewitt up as a dangerous source for our lawmakers to rely upon. You know, there are meaningful policy questions about whether states should create a new entitlement for able-bodied adults, especially when the track record, as Bob just said, has been really, really poor. But this idea that Medicaid expansion is going to really save the business community from the effects of Obamacare is just, you know, not true. And it would behoove lawmakers to really look at these issues carefully instead of relying on, you know, these flaw-filled reports that come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would...
Excellent. Thank you. Yeah, please go ahead.
Sure. I would add to that, you know, the calls are, let's rush into this thing. Let's do it fast. Get into it. Which is kind of ironic since they're telling the states, rush into Medicaid. Meanwhile, we're going to delay everything else in the law. And I think one should take some good advice from those delays. Clearly, the administration understands that there are some very unpalatable, unworkable parts that they're delaying. And as I said, I think some of them, which may never come into effect. And the state legislators might want to take a similar tack and say, well, you know, the administration is going to be delaying on everything. Maybe we should delay this and think it through completely. And thinking it through requires that you not simply look at the first round of effects, that $3,000 that Jackson Hewitt looks at, but all the other tendrils, all the other secondary and tertiary effects that this thing is going to have on state tax levels, on federal tax levels, on the quality of care, et cetera. And, you know, I'll just add one thing. I think Jonathan was talking a little bit earlier about how unpalatable it is to put people onto Medicaid and then throw them off. Well, we've actually seen that happen in a couple of failed expansions, most notably the 10-care disaster in Tennessee, where the state decided quite some years ago, close to 20 years ago, let's go ahead and expand Medicaid, bring a lot more people into it. They did so. They took them in. The state treasury nearly went bankrupt in the process. And at the height of the crisis, they essentially mailed out something like 200,000 letters saying, you know that insurance coverage that you've had? Well, you don't have it anymore. And, you know, when push comes to shove, when you break the budget, terrible things like that can happen. The politically unthinkable becomes thinkable.
Well, thank you both very, very much for taking the time to talk with us about this important issue and for the research that you both have done. Thank you also certainly to all of everyone who joined us and to our co-sponsors for helping us get the word out and for all the work that they do. We are going to have a recording of this call posted on our website, uncoverobamacare.com, as well as a transcript. So if you'd like to get a copy of this or to pass it on to others who'd be interested in it, please do that. We'll send that out by email, those links, after the call. So again, thank you to Director of Research, Jonathan Ingram, to Dr. Robert Graybois, and we will talk to you all again soon. Have a great day.